I'm Tom Raber.
And I'm Ethan Devitt.
Welcome to this podcast, the first Alvine Talks podcast, Peter Densick. It's wonderful to have you on board, and we've known each other for quite some time. I will try to see if I can summarize some of your lengthy career, and then I'll hand it over to Ethan to ask some of the questions, and then I will, of course, ask some further questions down the line. Your parents came to Sweden in 1939. You were born in 1943. You grew up in Gothenburg. You went on to become an economics professor at the University of Gothenburg. You worked there for a long time. You gained a good reputation. And from that, you were asked to come to Denmark, where you spent 22 years working at two prestigious universities, the University of Copenhagen and the University of Roskilde. And then you were asked to become the deputy managing director of PKA. And then whilst you were there, you were asked to come to London to work for what was a very reputable firm at the time, Singer Friedlander. And then at Singer and Friedlander, you got in touch with what was Key Asset Management that no longer exists. That was a hedge fund or fund business. And from there, you went on to join Alvine Capital as the non-executive chairman. So I know that's a very, very short introduction of a very long and distinguished career, Peter.
Thanks, Tom. So, Peter, I always try to fill in the human story behind the resume. And going back to your early days then, what was it that led to your interest in economics, investment, that area?
Well, I think my interest started with economics. Investment came later. So I studied and social science. I think if you translate it to the English circumstance, it would be something like PPE. And then specialized in economics and took my master in economics and then started as a lecturer and so forth and so on. But I primarily taught in macroeconomics. And that's why I wanted to make the correction. But I came in as a chief economist. That's how I came to PKA after being a university teacher for, 15 years, something like that. But then when the rules changed in Denmark, this was in Denmark. And at that time, if I may just make that comment, at that time, pension funds were not allowed to invest abroad. And pension funds were obliged to have, I think in those days, it was close to 80% in bonds. So it was not a very, inverted commas, sexy activity. And most of the bonds were either mortgage-backed bonds or government bonds, Danish government bonds. Then in the late 80s, then we started, and I was probably one of them, to push supervisory authorities to allow for pension funds to invest abroad. And I wrote some papers about risk diversification and the smallness of the Danish market compared with the big pension funds and all that. So slowly they started to allow A, more investment in equities, B, international investments. And then I was asked to look into for PKA's international investments, and that's how it started. And in the beginning, we connected with a mutual friend, a deceased, Cordy Wright from Pragma in Brussels, who then became a consultant to PKA. And that's how I came into international investment and selection of funds, which was the main. And that put me in contact with, as Tom said, Singer and Friedlander. And ultimately in the 95, I was to join them to build up their institutional business.
And it's interesting that you already back then saw the importance of diversification. And I'd love just, even though we just fast forward a little bit to the Danish economy today, it still seems there is a little bit of concentration in that market still, correct? Because we hear about the stock market and its domination by Novo Nordisk.
Yes.
So I suppose we've made some improvements, but there's still going to be an economy of that size, a bit of concentration.
In those days, Novo Nordisk was not that big. They were two separate companies, by the way. They merged in the late 80s to become Novo Nordisk. But they were dominated rather by the shipping industry. And food industry were the main sectors in Denmark in those days. But it was still a constant and small. I mean, Denmark, all respect to Denmark. But it's 6 million inhabitants. And in Denmark, you had a labor market pension reform. So all employees were contractually obliged to be member of a pension fund. And we had these industrial-wide pension funds, not they were kind of defined contribution plans, kind of hybrid, but they were defined contribution plans. Typically, the employee paid one third and the employer two thirds of contribution. It's about around, let's say, 3 + 9 or something like that, or 4 + 8. It varies a little bit. So you got huge pension funds. They were growing. And as they, most of them were young pension funds, you had no payout. So it was an enormous inflow of cash into the pension funds. And suddenly we were sitting there with all this cash coming in and had to place it in the market. So it was too small. That was the argument, that we needed to get out of the Danish. First of all, a lot of invest in equities, which created some discussion about among the more right-wing part of the Danish politics, because suddenly this was pension fund governed partly by the trade unions. And that creates some tension, political tension, that how, what happened if the pension funds start to own the companies? That was resolved later, and the pension fund turned out to be quite sensible owners.
And Peter, when you came and when you left Denmark to come to the UK, obviously, it seems to me that in the mid-90s, the UK was a much more open market than what you were used to in Denmark. So you probably partially came here because it gave you more bandwidth in terms of investments. And that's the first question. And the second question I wanted to ask you is that you obviously have subsequently left the UK. And I know you're fierce anti-Brexit campaigner, but I don't want this to be a political podcast, but I just want to ask you, in terms of free and open markets, how do you feel about how things were in 95 and how things were when you left after the Brexit referendum in 2016?
The reason why I came to Denmark in 95, I was asked to join Singer Friedland, it was actually a little bit interesting, because in the early 90s, PKA, the pension I worked for, we had the idea to enter into asset management for third parties. And we were looking for partners in UK and even in Denver, Colorado, talked to them there. And we went around and talked to many companies. But in the end, we couldn't reach an agreement. So one of the companies we talked to was Singer Friedland. They asked me then, well, instead of us doing something together, why don't you come and join us and build up the institution business for us, which I did then. And of course, I mean, you know as well, Tom, that if you are in the financial market in the 90s, London was quite attractive. And it was where it all happened. So that was an attraction. I think most of us in those days had the desire or the thought that to work in London. So right. That was a very open-minded and both the market, but also socially, intellectually, but very open-minded. Then when the Brexit came, I felt it narrowed in. And I felt that, yeah, to be honest, I felt the Europe bashing which took place in UK was not very nice. And I thought, or my wife and I, we thought, well, we don't have to live here. We can live wherever we like. So we decided to move back to Sweden.
Right, I understand. As a follow-up, I mean, when you left Denmark, people say, the happiness index in the world, I think, is the highest in the world in Denmark. Yeah. And it's quite low in the UK. How do you feel about that?
I don't give too much about the happiness index. I went to a literary festival in Denmark last summer in Louisiana. And there was an author from Nigeria who said that he had looked at the happiness index and Nigeria was regarded as the third most happy country in the world. And he didn't record. And I thought, well, so those indices are probably not worth very much. But I think Denmark is in general, more easygoing, more laid back, and their work-life balance, work-family balance, balance between work and other activities is much better than in UK. Even in the financial sector in Denmark, you had worked much shorter hours than you do in London. And I'm not sure that Denmark wasn't as productive as UK.
I think you've certainly been good at following the zeitgeist when it comes to where the energy is. We will eventually talk about your leadership style. But before that, since we are looking at the chronology now, looking back at your career, what were some of the highs and lows?
In terms of personal, I mean, I'm not talking about highs and lows in terms of financial, but that's not so interesting. Personal, I think when I was asked to join Singer Freenet and move to London, I think that probably was for me, I don't know, say a vindication, but for me it was something, you know, that was not that common, that you went from a pension fund in Denmark and got a job as a head of institutional business in a very old, I wouldn't say British, English investment, but merchant bank even, you know. So that felt a little bit a low point, probably October 87. And I'll tell you why. We had just started our international investment in August, September 87. We had signed our first agreement with a US and one UK asset management. We had transferred the money. And then the 87 crash came. And I was on holiday in Gothenburg, and my boss called me and said, what have we done? And then we have to explain for the board, which consisted of half of them county council, half of them trade unionists. And we had spent time convincing them why we should do international investments. And now here we were 2 months in, and we had inverted comma on the paper, lost money. That was a tough situation, but we managed, we convinced them with that. And then obviously we all know end of 87, the market were above what it ended in positive territory. So that was fine.
That's great. Lessons learned from that experience, and maybe just pulling the lens back a little. So clearly markets come back from downturns. It feels at the time that they will not. And now with a career as long as yours, as many decades as that, Tom and I are getting close, but we probably haven't seen quite as many cycles as you have. What would you say are kind of your takeaways from that? Maybe just how you look at markets and the boom-bust cycle and how you interpret them.
I think as I have dealt with institutional investors all my life, when I've been in finance, I was over institutional investors. So that's what I've dealt with, long-term investors. So the takeaway is that probably what I have learned. And that's why, you know, 87 is a good example, and many other crashes and cycles. So don't try to time it. Do a strategic asset allocation. If you're a pension fund, you it's based on your liability sides, and you do the strategic investment and you stick to it.
It's a good answer. It's the only thing I would say is to hold your nerve when you have situations like what you think at a time is a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence. So we've recently had situations like COVID, we've had the invasion of Ukraine, we've had all these events. Now we've got the situation in the Middle East, for example, and it is very difficult to do. And I just want to add that it does take experience, I think, because when you are in the situation and you see these types of things around you, you think, well, this time it is different. But what you are saying, Peter, is what you've learned over 50 years is that what goes around comes around, as it were. I mean, this may be the wrong expression in this particular context, but you know what I mean, is that things do come back, and hold your nerve is the way to do it, and don't have a knee-jerk reaction.
No, and try to understand the trends rather than the cycles.
The question is, Peter, the last two decades of your career, you've transitioned from being an economist to being an institutional investor to becoming a senior manager, both as a CEO and a chairman. And what are, in your opinion, the leadership qualities that you have that you try to instill in the people working for you, as well as what are the qualities that you appreciate in people that you're looking for in the people that work for you?
Okay, so in terms of quality in leadership, I think I put a lot of emphasis on talking to staff and try to understand their view of things and try to listen to them. I always believe in that you need to leave a negotiation. It can be with the staff, it can be when you talk about other companies, leave a situation where both parties feel that they have got something out of it. I don't see it as a zero-sum game. I see it that we have to get something out of it, both parties, all parties. And that leads me to the second part, which is that I believe that in a company, being a smaller company like the one I have the pleasure of being involved with for a moment, Allen Capital, or other companies, or the pension fund, that I believe that we should approach it as a collective task. I don't believe in focusing too much on the individual. I believe in focusing on the team. We are in together, we thrive together, we suffer together, but we are in it together. And then I think also the third part is that I always, when I meet new staff, people have been employed, I always end my conversation with that. You can, it doesn't matter if that's the junior staff or senior staff, you can always call me. You can always call me and talk to me in confidential, if you want, about things. So I think that's basically would sum it up, yeah.
That's wonderful. And exactly the kind of insights I knew you would share in this forum. What makes an effective non-executive chairman?
I think my role as a non-executive chairman is mainly to be there as an advisor, a board plank for the executive, for the management committee, for the managing director. He, in our case, isn't he, could be a she, should always be able to call me, raise issues, ask me to, can you please, we have a problem here, can you please talk to them, intervene, can you give me advice? I think that's the main part. And then secondly, if you have a company, I have to say this, where you have one dominant shareholder and some minority shareholders, it's important that you as a non-executive chairman take the view of the company. So you should be able and have confidence to tell the shareholders, you can't do this because this is not in the best interest of the company. Or it might be the best interest short term for one or two shareholders, but it's not for the company. So in that respect, I think I should make the point that I'm not a shareholder in the company. I think that's important. That gives me a freedom to take the view of the company. I feel as a representative, the company with capital C, if you like.
And do you feel, Peter, that in the alternative industry of hedge funds and private markets, that many of the firms actually don't have that? In fact, what they do have is they have a founder. The founder is essentially on top of the pile, and every decision that's being made of importance, regardless of the structure, ultimately ends up with that person. And that's something that's almost the fault of the hedge fund and the alternative industry, that there isn't more actual governance.
Yeah, I think that's a problem. And I think the history of the hedge funds is that we have had many unpleasant events due to there has been no governance, not enough control. And the founder or the manager owner has done things or take decisions which was not in best interest, neither for the other shareholders, staff, or indeed the investors. No. The history of hedge funds is riddled with those cases. So I think even in a smaller company, corporate governance is quite important. I believe in structure, you know that. I believe in structure. I believe that transparency, people should know who is responsible for what and who takes what kind of decision. And they should be accountable internally as well as externally.
I love that. And I want to go back to something we spoke about earlier about negotiation, because I see you as being a master of that art. And this podcast is being a masterclass in the Peter Densick and negotiation skills for life. So you mentioned about leaving something on the table. And what would be the other kind of principles, I suppose, that you bring to a negotiation, and how has that evolved maybe over your career?
I think I'm moving more and more in the direction from, if you like, one word, the zero-sum game view on a negotiation to negotiation. It's a joint effort of both parties to find a solution. And I think you need to respect your counterpart. And it could be, the canteen staff, or it could be the managing director. I don't care. You need to respect them. They have all their views and you have to listen to them. And sometimes you can't fulfill what they want, of course, because you have a company or you have limited resources and so forth and so on. But you then have to explain and listen to them and try to get them to understand why you do what you're doing and what's the implication. And it's not directed toward them as individuals. It's because a company is in certain situation. And you, my experience is, whatever it's worth, is that usually if you treat people reasonably and respect their views and listen to them without accepting necessarily the view, but you do respect, you listen to them, say, yes, I understand where you come, but this is my problem. So let's sit down and try to find a solution. I had just a couple of days ago such a situation where it was quite a tough one. But, you know, spent the weekend, exchanged an email, had a long conversation on the phone, and I think we both parties ended up in a good solution where we are happy to work together going forward.
And I suppose you don't always have the situation where the other counterparty sees things in the same way.
No.
They may see things as a zero-sum game. How do you approach that? Do you just try to take the high ground?
Yes, usually I do. Usually I do. I think it's for Tom to comment on that, but I think I usually do. I think we have had Tom together one or two cases, but I think usually if people see it zero-sum game and you approach them and say, well, look here, my friend, this is not a zero-sum. I'm not here to win over you. I'm here to find a solution. Most people would say, well, that makes sense. I mean, it's very hard to maintain the view then. If one party says, I'm here to find a solution, then, well, I'm not, I'm here to win. But there have been situations where perhaps you say, well, then we can't continue. And then you have to take a decision that it's not compatible with what we are doing in the company. And then perhaps, you know, you have to find something else to do.
Can I ask you, Peter, when you do that in a negotiation, do you actually have a roadmap in front of you where you kind of know where you're going, or you've done it so many times you can kind of almost ad lib?
No. I usually have, and I usually write it down on a piece of paper before. I usually have an idea, because usually you know the people or the guy or the company you're talking to, and you know what is important for them. So I usually try to play out in my head the negotiation, and I write down where I want it to end and where are my, to use a very frequent used term, where are my red lines? Where are the red lines for the company I'm supposed to represent? And very often I end roughly where I thought I should end.
Preparation is key then,
yes,
to the process.
Yeah, and again, try to understand what the other party wants. What is most important for the other party? Is it title? Is it money? Is it position? Is it career? Is it whatever? And try to find a sweetener. Well, if you do this, I can send you to a conference, or I can give you, you know, something else, and whatever it is, to round it up. And thank you very much for being so productive and discussion, and you depart as good friends.
And I've always known you in this chair role and the function of a great sage, with the looking back and using many decades of experience. But just putting your investment hat on now, given you've worked in investing institutions for decades, what excites you when you look around the world today in terms of opportunity set? Where do you think you work with Alvine, which is obviously focused on funds and how they grow? Where do you see the next frontier will be in terms of growth?
Well, the moment, as the world looks like now, not very much excites me, I must admit. But I still, perhaps a little naive, believe in Europe as a concept. I do. And I think if Europe can get it right in terms of infrastructure investments, especially on the green side, and if we can get the European Union to work more focused on, I think that there's a quite interesting opportunity here. And perhaps de-link a little bit from the US in terms of maybe dependence in everything from technology to other things. I think there could be quite an interesting case. But that is perhaps more me as a European wishing something than being realistic. I don't know.
Certainly a lifelong Europhile, but it's not a particularly popular view, of course, today, as the US has been the juggernaut of the global markets and growth. So very interesting to kind of restate, I suppose.
I'm a strong believer in Europe as a political project, and I think we should have much more coordinated. I would probably fit the description of a federalist, I guess.
Okay, well, that's very good. Just one more thing in terms of the geopolitical situation with the year of the elections, they call 2024.
Yes.
There's obviously one in the US. There will probably be one in the UK. I think there have just been one in Bangladesh and Congo.
Yes.
There are lots of other ones coming up.
Taiwan over the weekend, yeah.
Yeah, so obviously it's volatile, it's difficult. But I go back to what you said before, which is try to sit still in the boat, meaning that if you've done your work, you've done your asset allocation, and you're happy with what you're doing, don't try to do too many tactical changes. Just stay the course. And is that still your view in 2024, despite all the, if we call it uncertainties? But as we said earlier, there are always uncertainties. So what's your view?
Then you have to start to think about what is the connection between political uncertainties and market uncertainties. And it's not given that the one leads to another. For example, in the US, with the uncertainty, political uncertainties, and God forbid we get another term with Trump, that will create a very unpleasant situation in the US. I'm not that sure it would have a negative impact on the market, though. So I think you have to differentiate between the two types of uncertainties.
Well, so Peter, we talked a lot about long-term and zero-sum game. Yeah. And I want to talk to you about the sales process and what makes a good salesperson. Because as we know, that is one of the skills that is probably one of the most difficult to build. Do you think good salespeople are born or made?
I think some people are more natural salespeople than others. And I could point on one case where it's a very natural salesperson is sitting in the studio. And I could put in, and there are other people who are try very hard but don't succeed because they are good marketing people in terms of presenting a case. They are good to introduce, to schmooze, all that type. But when they come to the very end, you know, to close a deal, they're not there. I've had so many cases of those. But I think, I think it's a personality issue. I think it is. But then again, I think you have to differ between what you're selling. Well, we are not selling refrigerators here. We are selling a long-term investment. So that's a different kind. So you need the investor to be happy with the investment. Because mind you, the investor, the guy you talk to, he could be a CIO in a pension fund or an insurance company. So he has then to defend this decision to his board, to his masters. So it's not just selling, it's also giving him the argument why not he, but they should invest in that product.
It's so important to listen to what investors really want and try to fulfill their needs. We're in the world with information overload, and allocators are constantly inundated with salespeople that are literally just trying to push something through the door. And I don't think that works. And you and I are in agreement. I know if we're going to move on from sales, this is one of Ethan's topics. She asked about sales, so I'll ask about diversity. So we'll switch roles here. I just wanted to ask you, what's your view on diversity in organizations and how that's going in terms of various aspects, and how do you feel, and what has been your input when it comes to this in your career? Do you feel that we're making progress?
We meaning in general financial?
In general, in the industry is what I mean.
No, I think we're making progress. Definitely, we are definitely making progress. But I think it's very important because also in the micro sphere, I mean, in a small company, that you both have male and female or different people, different culture background, because otherwise you risk to be a closed shop and you will not be open for new input. I don't believe this school tie approach. No, I think you should be open and diversified and give people from different background the chance. I can tell you a story, if I may. When I first joined Singer Freelander, we should hire a person on the investment side. And I did, you know, I read the CV and I interviewed him and his pro and con and so forth and on. And then my chairman should have a talk. And he said, I'm not interested in what his CV, I'm not interested in what does. I'm interested in which school he went to. And that I thought, you know, and that approach I really dislike. So I think openness, diversity is very important. Both, but I think that London is quite interesting because London, what I realized when I came to London 95, perhaps not so much in the very English merchant bank I joined. That probably I was the diversity. I stood for the diversity there because I came from abroad. But otherwise, I thought London was quite diverse and open-minded in terms of culture background, not so much in terms of school and education, but in terms of culture background.
Do you think that has changed now since?
I think so. It has changed. I think just because you are from that public school or from that university doesn't necessarily give you a platform. I think now you're scrutinized more. What can you add to the party?
It's interesting, though, because that individual who wanted to know the school only probably just said the quiet part out loud, because I think that's often how we do shortcuts. It is different. Yeah. Hiring is one of probably the most challenging pieces of any enterprise. Making the right hire, ensuring they're going to work and contribute and be the most effective employee you can get. And then you have to have some shortcuts to that process in order to save time sometimes. So I think that is probably still going on to a degree, hopefully less, but it'll go on in other forms as well, as we try to just cut to the chase in terms of finding the right person.
It's important to get the right, especially the male-female part, to get the right work-life balance in the office. And if you only have young men from Oxbridge in the 30s, a single man, you get a totally different office than if you have some people there who say, well, I have to leave now because I have to get my child from creche.
I want to, before we move on to the reflection section, which I'm looking forward to in particular with you, I'd love to ask, just getting back to that people part, because you started out as an economist, you started out, you know, looking at numbers, looking at models. And I think one of the parts that's overlooked, behavioral economics probably wasn't a huge part of it then.
No.
You know, behavioral, just analysis of how people behave. Tom is a long believer in the importance of networks and personal connection. And you've talked about long-term games. So I suppose, what is your takeaway now, looking back, on the importance of people and networks throughout your career?
First of all, perhaps, is that never burn any bridges when you talk to people or when you leave a company. I mean, it's quite interesting, if I may make a deviation. Tom and I were first on the same side. He got me into Key. Then we were on the opposite sides, because I was tasked to negotiate a deal to buy out Tom from Key. So we obviously had different interests. And here I am ending up in the company he owns, and for now, how long is it? 15 years being his chairman. So that, I think that's a good example that you can be on different side in a negotiation. Don't make it personal. And never burn the bridge, because you never know when you need to cooperate again. And that one, our business dealing with institutional investors and GPs, general partners, it's very important because there are so many of them. So you talked previously of screening, and the network helps you do screening because you trust certain people. You can talk to certain people, you can pick up the phone, and they can introduce you to interesting target, or you can talk to them and say, do you know X, Y, Z? So I think network is very important, especially in our business where you deal with institutional investors.
Over to you, Tom, to kick off reflections, unless there's anything you want to bring up before we go to that section.
No, I think this is a very good time to do that. So I just wanted to go back. So when you look back, Peter, on your career would must be over five decades. I think one of the things you've done, before I ask you a specific question, which you've done better than anyone I know, is you've been able to reinvent yourself. And I wanted to ask you about that, because many people that end up on Wall Street or in the city in London, they tend to end up in a specific role. And then once they are no longer in that role, they're like a fish out of water, and they don't really know what to do. And that may be particularly on the trading side, but also on the sales side. You know one thing, you know it well. When that no longer is there, you don't know what to do. was you've been able to move effortlessly between various different parts of economics and finance, from the buy side to the sales side, to be a manager, senior manager, etc. And I would like to see ask you how you do that. I mean, has that been a plan or has that just happened?
No, it hasn't been a plan. I must admit that it hasn't been. It's been opportunity being presented to me, and I have taken the opportunity. And I think it has to do with your view that, again, it goes back to this, if you look at things as a holistic or a particular. I think I'm a kind of guy who looks at things as holistic, try to see different side, different aspect on it. And then the things are intervening. You talk about buy or sell side. For me, it wasn't that a big, when I moved from PK, where I was on the buy side, to Senior Freedom when I was on sales, it was not a big deal. It was a question to understand what product do the institutional investor need? How can we provide those products and argue why they should have it and why should I buy it or why should I sell it? It's not a big difference. And then moving from macroeconomic to finance, I think that again was that, we started to argue why we need to diversification from a more macro point of view. And then I was asked, could you help us? And could you develop that? And then you knocked on my door, 2003, I think it was, wasn't it?
And yes, something like that. Yes. No, I understand. And speaking about people that you have yourself looked up to in your career, in your life, is there any key people who have had a particular influence?
There's one person. He was the managing director of PKA, the guy who hired me, who was my mentor. And I have learned a lot by sitting next to him. Ben Lucke, if I called. He passed away 2 years ago, unfortunately. But I can tell you a story about, which is give you also this type of leadership he had.
Sure.
This was in autumn 1994. I had been approached by Singer Friedlander to join them. And he had before that, when I started to look into different possibilities for PK, he said, I think you might be attractive to the market, so I want to lock you in. So he locked me in for a while. But I went to him then in December 94 and said, look, I got this offer now. I know I have 6 months or 8 months notice period, but they want me to start to work 1st of February. Then he said something which I will never forget. He said, I would be a very poor boss if I prevented one of my staff to develop and do what he wants to do. So yeah. Of course you can start 1st of February.
Very good.
And that has been with me all the time. And that is that listen to what the counterpart wants, try to understand, and also in terms of staff, develop them, give them the chances. Don't confront your staff. That never leads any good.
Well, a really key lesson for life there. Peter, our last question gets to, I suppose, the wisdom that some of these individuals may have shared with you or that you have internalized over the years. And we've still captured quite a bit of that in terms of your philosophy around negotiation, around staff, around careers. But would you say that any creed or motto that has really characterized your approach, whether professionally or personally, or any words of wisdom that you can share with us now?
When we had our Christmas lunch at Elvine, I ended with quoting the motto of the European Union. You wouldn't be surprised by that. Which says, unity in diversity. And that probably is a good motto for leadership in a company as well.
I love it. And no surprise that it's from a Europhile like yourself. It is all bringing it together in terms of whether a political philosophy, a life philosophy, a professional philosophy. So this has been an absolute pleasure, Peter, to hear your wisdom here. Many decades of wisdom distilled into less than an hour. So I'm sure we've left pieces out. I think we've a lot of takeaways from this. I'll leave it to Tom to share his thanks as well. But from my perspective, this has been an extraordinary educational hour here with you. So thank you for sharing your insights.
Thank you for having me. I love it.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. I just wanted to add to Ethan that it's been a pleasure working with you and it's been a pleasure talking to you today. And I think it was a wonderful idea to have you on the podcast so that we can share some of the wisdom and some of your experience with people that don't get to interact with you as much as we do. So Wonderful. You're 80 now. We look forward to working with you for the next decade. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you very much.
So, Ethan, that was a lot to take in by Peter Densick, who's been in finance and business for 50 years. And he gave some of his personal experiences and was very open about what he'd gone through and how he saw the world in the early days and today. And the remarkable thing is that he's still working at the age of 80, which is quite a skill. What was your take?
Yeah, well, I've always known Peter as an artful negotiator. And I suppose what surprised me a little is how holistically he thinks of that as not being a zero-sum game. That was a real learning to me because I think he does execute that task with grace and elegance. I've always seen as being a very successful negotiator. And I suppose what's surprising to me is that you can be so successful and yet you can leave the other party feeling that they've also won something in that. So that was an incredible takeaway. And just his focus on the long term as well, that I suppose after a long career, you have to have that long term understanding. But it really reinforced the importance of, as you said, staying in the boat and not being deterred by the waves.
And I mean, having worked with him, the other thing I would like to add is that when it comes to, I think sometimes on, again, Wall Street types of jobs, and the mentality tends to be every man for himself. And he is, in fact, the complete opposite of that. He's actually looking out for everyone rather than for himself. And I think that is something that people feel when they talk to him. And that's why they trust him. And that's why they want to do business with him. And as you said, when it comes to negotiations, people feel that. People aren't looking for what's in it for me, but rather what's in it for both of us. Then it's obviously a lot easier to come to a satisfactory conclusion for all parties. And he is a master at it. So it was a great pleasure to have him on our first podcast. And we look forward to seeing how his career progresses from here.
Absolutely. And just a quick question on that collective point, that collective interest point. Do you think that's something uniquely Scandinavian? I know during COVID, we spoke a lot about the difference between the collective interest societies and the individualist societies. Is that something that maybe is part of your education system in Sweden, or any connection with that?
It's an interesting point you make. I think there is some of that, clearly. I mean, the Nordic countries obviously have this kind of overtune of socialism, you know, everybody kind of on the same level, you know, nobody should be above anyone else type of mentality, which is healthy. I think that is healthy. Equally, you may not sometimes want to have too much of that because then nothing ever really happens. You know, you need to have some entrepreneurism and you need to have some individual drive as well. But I do think it probably comes from there. And I do think I remember from somewhere somebody saying that the managers in the Nordic countries of large public companies are the best in the world. And why is that? Because they're not just looking out for their own good, they're looking out for the entire company. And that's probably what Peter has a bit of.
And that's the difference, I think, because he did stress when on the governance side, the interests of the company. And I think the interest of the company may not always be the same as the interest of every individual. So therefore, he's not trying to please everyone all the time. And nor can it be compatible with everyone, all the stakeholders kind of having their individual agendas met. So I think that's the difference. Is he may be focused on the collective, but he is far from a walkover. And if anything, he is a shrewd focuser on the business and a very successful commercial focus. So I think that's the interesting blend we get in Peter. So very interesting conversation.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice. And all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.